On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Go on this, the 26th day of May, 2015. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. And this is day two of Naked Radio in the Horn Studio Sauna. Or the Horn Sauna Studio. Either way, it's a toasty 82 degrees in here and going up. Yes, indeed. We're beginning to get those summer-like temperatures. Yeah. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is a, well, we all know this, but you know, it goes to the beginning of the program. This is a listener-supported broadcast enterprise. We're not selling anything. We don't have any memberships. We don't have any certificates suitable for framing or secret decoder rings or BB rifles with a compass in the stock. Nothing. Just, what we got is 3 hours of progressive conversation broadcasting 5 nights a week for 3 hours a night, as well as Dr. Bill in the afternoons, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, our good friend Rick Smith, Soldiers On in the afternoons. Yeah, that's what the Horn is. And we do it all without the first ad for encouraging you to buy gold now or any of that other malarkey. We don't have any ads for herbal tonics that will grow hair on a bowling ball that you then pick up off of your Swedish mattress made of foam developed by NASA and with an auric vacuum cleaner while listening to Rush Limbaugh on your Bose Wave radio. None of that. None of that. It's strictly listener support, and we try to raise $200 an evening. And the way we do that is through the PayPal interface at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, where you will find a number of fields, some of which are rather pushy and invasive, and you need not fill them out. Just put enough information there to click next and get to the next screen and do all the PayPal stuff. Some of you, however, do not like to work, do not like to use PayPal, and, well, that's certainly understandable. Oh, really? Am I going to? Oh, shoot. I've come to the conclusion that headphone cables are made of quite possibly the most delicate substances on earth. Because you can't keep one around. So I got audio in one ear. Whatever. But anyway, some of you don't particularly care to deal with PayPal, and you prefer to use the U.S. Postal Service, and that's fine and dandy. For those of you who would like to do it that way, well, you know, what you need to do is, checks and money orders are best because, well, cash has been known to get lost in the mail. I think the Cincinnati, I was told once by the postmistress down the road here, the Cincinnati sorting facility has more theft than any other postal facility in the United States, and in fact, everything coming here just about winds up going through Cincinnati. But anyway, checks and money orders to The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. And, yeah, checks and money orders made payable to The Horn as well, because Boss Man Wayne deals with all of that. And, well, if they're made out to Bob Kincaid, they become rather difficult for him to deposit. Okay? Okay. So hopefully we will clear this evening's fundraising goal. We have a monumental amount of bills that persist. It's been a, well, it's been a rather bill-laden month when you get right down to it. And we're just trying to keep everything afloat. So, you know, 10 people at $20 a piece, 20 people at $10 a piece, 40 people at $5 a piece, one at 200, two at 100, four at 50, eight at 25, and that's about as far as I can go with all the gazettas right about now. Now, a reminder as to scheduling. One, I'm looking forward to, we're going to have a guest evangelist tomorrow for prayer meeting Wednesday, and I hope you will be on board and tuned in for that. Right there at the top of the program, this could get rather interesting rather quickly. And then next week gets weird, and that's why it's so important that we keep up with our fundraising goal for the week and the coming weeks. Next week it gets weird because I'm going to be away from the microphone a little bit. Typical, ordinary, More End Monday broadcast. Tuesday, on the road to Cleveland. Tuesday evening, we will, God willing, you never know till you get there and see what the setup is, we'll be broadcasting the memorial for Bill, Mr. Stress Miller, live from the Euclid Tavern on Euclid Avenue, not too far from University Circle in Cleveland, Ohio. The Euclid Tavern being where the Mr. Stress Blues Band held forth for many, many years and brought much enjoyment to many people. So we'll be there. And then the next day, Wednesday, we get back on the road and go howling down I-77, trying to get back here in time to do a program on Wednesday, because Thursday and Friday, we're gone. And we've got to keep up with all of this. You get the idea. And of course, gone, as I mentioned before, gone Thursday and Friday because our youngest, the lovely, talented, brilliant Doodle, is graduating from high school, and we've got family coming in from 1,000 miles away, and we're all just going to be together and make it all about Doodle for a couple of days. And then come June 8th, Monday, June 8th, everything's back to as close to normal as we can ever get it. Okay? Okay. So that having been said, God, time out. Damn it! Sorry, not trying to be a diva, but I gotta sort out this headphone business. Okay, is it? Do I have? Check one. Yeah, I think I've got audio in both ears. Okay. And, okay, and there we, okay, never a dull moment. Maybe that's going to work now. Who knows? Engineering on the fly. Yeah, I can, y'all can hear me. I will probably be able to hear you at least one ear, but it's awfully frustrating. Letting go now. Letting go now, letting everything go, yes. Going to my happy place. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy in Vermont, noting loud and clear on TuneIn, Bob. Thank you. That means that we are reaching. Yes. It is at 11 minutes past the hour, of course, Titanic Tuesday on the horn. Yeah, well, Marty, suffer quietly. I mentioned the second day of Naked Radio in the Horn Studio sauna. Marty said, thanks for the visual, Bob, just what I didn't want. Watch it, or I'll turn the damn camera on, and no, we won't. I promise. There's not enough eye bleach in America if I was to do that. And by the way, something was shared with me. Dr. Bill received a lovely email today, and he forwarded it on and shared it with me. So just a special good evening greeting to Lucy in Arizona. It's just an absolutely delightful email. Like I said, Dr. Bill shared it with me, so it was addressed to him, but it says, "This is pure and simple, just a fan mail letter to you. I've now listened to you for several months on the horn, and my respect and admiration for your views knows no bounds." That's pretty hefty praise. Indeed. And, of course, it is toward Dr. Bill. And it is entirely well-deserved, as far as I'm concerned. Dr. Bill, being certainly one of the most erudite American historians that I have ever had the privilege of getting to know. And my admiration for him also knows no bounds. You, too, will probably feel that way if you will make a point from either 1 to 3 or 1:30 to 3, that's Tuesdays, 1 to 3 on Mondays and Wednesdays. Check out Dr. Bill O'Brien and the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. There is more about American history to be learned in that program than in a whole bunch of college courses. In point of fact, that's what Dr. Bill's been doing with the Horn and with the PRISM, PRISM, Teaching American History series, is putting out advanced degree level historic scholarship about the nature of the Republic. It is well worth your time. Of course, it's also archived and put up as a podcast at whiteroadsociety.org. But Lucy continues and says, "Both you and the," and this has just charmed me, because this has never, ever, ever, and I mean ever, happened before. "You and that darling Bob Kincaid are examples of people with integrity and goodwill and love for their fellow man." That darling Bob Kincaid. That is a phrase that has never before, until today, existed in the English language. Lucy continues, "Your analysis of the Federalist Papers was a source of learning and gave me great pleasure." And then this, which just makes everything beautiful. "I'm a 91-year-old former New Yorker living in Arizona because it's affordable in a retirement community for very old people." And Lucy says, "Just wanted to express my appreciation about both you and Bob Kincaid. Live your lives, such decent, generous, kind, and loving gentlemen." I read that earlier today to Agnes, and that generated a gigantic, "Oh," from her. She does not give those out profligately. It takes a lot to get an "aww" out of Agnes. So thank you very kindly for the lovely note, Lucy. And it's so nice to hear from people we've never heard from before, because, well, we know you're out there. We just don't necessarily hear from you. You know, we get used to people who call the program, and I love our ongoing conversations. It is, however, nice every now and then to be reminded, because you are certainly there. There are people who spend their precious finite time involved in this conversation who never get involved in it personally. And it's nice just to be reminded. That you're there. And yes, indeed, we think Lucy's pretty darling, too. Thank you, Lucy. Thank you also to Jeremy, who got us started this evening with fundraising for the night. Much obliged, Jeremy. He said, just wanted to knock off the first $5 for the evening. Thank you very, very kindly, Jeremy. Okay. It is... Do you sense that I'm hesitating? Do you sense that I'm sort of... I don't want to go in the swamp. We're going in the swamp because it's Titanic Tuesday. You might well recall that Titanic Tuesday is named for an incident that occurred years ago now when the 962nd tier right-wing blatherer over in Beckley, a guy named Steve, took a call from one of his mouth-walking, knuckle-breathing faithful, who asked him, Steve! And this was apparently right after Steve had gotten done reading the newspaper to his faithful. He did that most mornings, just read the Beckley paper to them in a magnificent monotone. Probably personally responsible for several asleep at the wheel accidents. But one caller, one mouth-walking, knuckle-breathing, serpent-swigging, strychnine-juggling, handling... never mind. Caller says, hey, Steve, how come you reckon it is there is seashell fossils in the rocks in West Virginia? We ain't nowhere near the beach. To which Steve responded, well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates. The Titanic plates. Still no word whatsoever on the movement of the Titanic napkin rings. Yes, it's we celebrate on these Tuesdays. We celebrate the right-wing Titanic intellect. Titanic in their own estimation of the size and breadth and scope of it. Titanic in our estimation for its willingness to bear down on stupidity and holler full steam ahead. Yeah, I got the hip waders on. I'm getting ready to jump in. Because it really is. It's Titanic Tuesday on the horn, and we got lots to work with. How about we travel down to dear old Alabamistan? Now, can't we just drink tequila? No. Sorry, inner monologue got loose for a minute there. Chief Justice Roy Moore, and, you know, the word justice in front of his name really does, is sort of an insult to the notion of it, but we'll get past that. They got a program over there at the Family Research Council run by Tony Norman. Yes, Mother Bates. Perkins. It's like Washington Watch or Washington Weirdos or, a bunch of snake fondling, whatever. And we had a little bit of this yesterday via a clip from Reverend Governor Pastor Diabetes Snake Oil Patent Medicine Cure Hustler Salesman Mike Huckstermy. This is becoming a thing in the right wing, and it is worth paying attention to because they are beginning to vibrate like a daggum tuning fork the nearer we get to a possible ruling on marriage equality in the United States, from the Supreme Court thereof. And the way the thinking goes, and it's a form of nullification, make no mistake, 155 years after the Civil War, the nullification is alive and well as a process of the Titanic intellect of the right wing in this country. You would think that 600,000 dead would put paid to an idea like nullification. Well, but you can take the white supremacist out of the Klan, but you can't take the Klan out of the white supremacist. And it's bled over from, and I do mean bled, from racism and segregation and Jim Crow into a, because see, evangelical fundamentalists have to have someone to hate in the name of their God. Otherwise, their God is not powerful. Their God is not all-powerful if their God isn't hating on somebody. And so, the nullification argument has, and you know, this is all driven through Alec and then Chuck and Dave Koch and Sheldon Adelson and the Teabaggers and Crossroads, whatever, something or another. That's true. Jeremy in Vermont noting, at least the Family Research Council is down one sick Duggar. No. Wait. I thought he was working for the American Family Association. No, maybe it was the... I can't keep up with them. I can't keep up with all these sickos. We got some Duggar in... I'm getting sick of this story. Really sick of this story. But we got some more Duggar background for you this evening that you're going to find just a charming, absolutely delightful piece of merriment delivered courtesy of the goddess of irony. But anyway, this notion, this nullification notion, that the several states and the governors thereof and the legislatures thereof and the preachers thereof, which the right-wing evangelical white-wing fundamentalists would like to make the same thing, you know, preachers and the government, right. Well, this notion that they can just ignore a potential Supreme Court ruling that they don't like, what is that but nullification? I mean, that's John C. Calhoun standing there saying, not only is slavery an acceptable institution, it is a noble institution. Yeah, he doubled down. Okay. So, this nullification idea that we're going to ignore the Supreme Court if it happens to rule in a way that these theocratic toddlers don't like, well, that's what Judge Roy Moore was on about when he went on the radio show with Tony Norman, yes, Mother Bates, Perkins. All right, okay, into the ankles, into the hips. Let's just go into the swamp. Here's Roy Moore.
What is the solution then, Chief Justice?
The solutions always go back to the United States Constitution and look and see. There's no word marriage in the Constitution.
Who can resist? Who has the ability to resist?
Congress. Congress should look at the United States Constitution, find clearly that there's...
Has Roy been drinking? Really? I'm familiar with the accent down there, but I'm also familiar with what that accent sounds like drunk. And I think Judge Roy has been drinking, because I think you have to have a little bit of old panther piss in your system before you start saying Constitution. I just always got to look at the Constitution. Sounds liquored up. You know what, Roy? And we had to go through this last night with Pastor Reverend Brother Governor Diabetes Miracle Cure Patent Medicine Snake Oil Salesman Mike Huxterby. You're right. We'll give you points. The word marriage does not exist in the Constitution. But equal protection of the laws does. Now, I understand, Roy Moore, that you being an Alabamian and you being a nullificationist and probably a secessionist and maybe even a Sons of Confederate Veterans, I understand that you don't like the Equal Protection Clause because it's one of those Civil War amendments that still has you upset and upset your great-great-grandpappy and your great-great-grandpappy and your great-grandpappy and your grandpappy and your pappy and you. And y'all been hooting and hollering about how the South will rise again. I understand that. I understand you don't like it, but not liking something doesn't make it not exist. And the Equal Protection Clause most assuredly does exist. And it says that all American citizens, all United States citizens, shall have the equal protection of the law. Now, I am sure that if you could get a few more shots of old Panther into him, Roy Moore would be happy to tell you, in the name of Jesus, that he wishes that the gay people could just have their citizenship taken away. And then we could deal with them as the Bible wants. More on that in a minute. But anyway, let's go back to slurring... not slurring the Constitution. Well, he's doing that too, isn't he? But slurring talking about the Constitution. Really, Sonny, I'm not nearly as thinky as the drunk I am.
Then just
cheap justice. Solutions always go back to the United States Constitution and look and see there's no word marriage in the Constitution.
Who can resist? Who has the ability to resist?
Congress. Congress should look at the United States Constitution, find clearly that there's no right to redefine marriage.
What about the states?
The states can also resist.
Okay, so once again, I just want to make clear, no one's redefining marriage. No one. No judges, nobody. In fact, the only redefinition of marriage that has been engaged in this country has been done by the right wing with their stupid little DOMA laws, their stupid little DOMA Defense of Marriage Amendments. Because it says that marriage shall be between one man and one woman. But in point of fact, that biblical marriage that they're so doggone fond of can be between one man and 972 wives and 312 concubines. And you know what? If you want to get right down to it, because I think about this a lot. I wish I didn't, but I do. When you get right down to it, a biblical marriage is a marriage between a man and possibly several womans and some camels and some goats and some lambs and some chickens and some sheep and maybe some gold and silver and barley and who not? Because the whole thing is the whole thing is the marriage. I mean, you don't get the little virgin, the little 14-year-old virgin female if you don't pony up the camels or the ponies. You see what I mean? So by not including the camels and the goats and the she wolves and the suckling lambs and chickens and barley and oats and groats and whatnot, well, they're the ones who redefined the marriage, and now they're pissed because it's blowing up in their faces. Stupid fundies.
States can bring cases up in their own state Supreme Courts, and they can define what authority they have.
See, this is all... Wait a minute. You know where this comes from? You know, a minute ago I was talking about stuff being passed down from great-great-great-great-great-grandpappy to great-great-great-grandpappy to great-great-grandpappy to great-grandpappy to grandpappy to pappy to... Right? Well, this is that. Because, see, way, way, way back in time... Well, not that far back. But Judge Roger B. Taney replaced Justice Marshall as Supreme Court Chief Justice. And he it was who was responsible for the dastardly, dead wrong, really rotten, filthy, hateful decision in the Dred Scott case, in which he said, nope, black folks are not human beings, black folks are not meant to be citizens of the United States, blah, 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 thereby necessitating later on the passage of the 14th Amendment and the 13th Amendment, right? Well, prior to that ruling coming down, I mean, the Dred Scott case was quite the celebrated case for its day. And all over the slaveholding South, they were wondering what they would do if the Dred Scott decision was to go against them, and the Supreme Court was to say that, of course, Dred Scott could be free since he was now in a free territory. But of course he had the full civil rights that appertaining unto him as an American citizen born in the United States, blah, blah, blah. And so the states worried about what they would do. And being nullificationists and being secessionists and having treason beating in their dirty hearts, these southern political types, well, you know what we'll do? We'll pass laws down here that'll say that the Supreme Court was wrong, and they ain't neither human being citizens of the United States of America, the greatest country in the world on earth right now forever. And we'll pass laws, and we'll have the court say stuff, and the legislatures will say stuff, and we'll just tell that Supreme Court where they can stick their rulings. Well, they never had to put that into practice because, of course, Chief Justice Roger Taney got it completely ass-backwards, dead-up, evil, wrong. But a dog returneth always to his vomit. Hey, it's dinner time. Sorry. But they do. And that's exactly where Judge Roy Moore has gone. Back into the filthy, hate-filled, bigoted annals with ink made of prejudice written on pages of hate of his forebears. Because understand, Judge Roy Moore does not give a tinker's damn about loyalty to his country. He does not give a damn about not committing treason, because after all, treason runs in the family. I'm sure that maybe even in Roy Moore's own home, they probably got old great-great-great-great-grandpappy's squirrel musket rifle, what he carried into battle against the bluebellies up to Shiloh. Or maybe they don't. Maybe great-great-great-great-grandpappy dropped it as he filled his drawers and ran away. But, you know, heritage is important to these people, and, you know, part of his heritage is, you know, treason. Oopsie! So now the treason is bubbling to the surface, and it's being propelled by the noxious gases of nullification. I just wish the dumb bastard would go ahead and say, well, you know what, if we don't get our way, you know what we need to do? Secede? Because it worked out so dang good the last time. He'd be right there with Jimmy Dick Perry. Yes, he would. Oh, but do continue, Roy. You effing traitor.
And if Supreme Court doesn't recognize it, that's up to the state authorities.
So, in our system of government, the Supreme Court is not the final say.
On matters pertaining to the Constitution? Yes, it is. How can this conversation even be taking place in the real world? Do you understand that these Southern bigots are acting as if the 14th Amendment simply does not exist? That in their hearts they've already nullified that? Kind of brings the whole thing into focus, doesn't it?
Well, the final say is the United States Constitution. It is not the words of justice. And that's constitutional law.
No, dumbass. Constitutional law is Marbury versus Madison, which says that the Supreme Court of the United States shall be the final interpreter of the Constitution. And you know what? I live with that. I deal with that. You know what? That was a fact when the court delivered the Slaughterhouse cases. That was the fact when the court delivered Plessy versus Ferguson. That was the fact when the court delivered Lochner. Okay, when the court delivered Schenck and Frowork and Debs. And every case I've just mentioned has been dead damned wrong. But if we want to live in a country where we do not wind up at each other's bayonet points every time we don't like something, we live with them and hope that we can correct them later. Schenkfroh work and Debs were corrected. Lochner was later corrected. God knows Plessy was later corrected. And they're still pissed about it. See, if you want to understand the essential atomic-level hypocrisy of the right wing in this country, especially these neo-Confederate nullificationists, understand this. When Plessy rolled around in the late 19th century, and it was a question of whether people of color could ride with decent, upstanding white people on the same railroad car. Well, the white wing was there to holler, "Well, of course not. What about the women folks? My stars and garters!" And for all we know, one of Lindsey Graham's forebears was involved in the case. Mercy sakes, I'll worry about it tomorrow. But I mean, we couldn't have the delicate flowers of Southern civilization being riding on the same old nasty old railroad cars with those people. And there weren't any Southerners there hollering, nope, the Constitution's the final word on this, not the Supreme Court. No, hell no, the court came out with its noxious, toxic Plessy decision. And the entire white South went, yay for the Supreme Court! They have delivered an opinion that is inspired by God! Because they liked the decision. Compare this, then, with how our side responds to something as odiously hateful and wrong as, say, Citizens United. Is there anybody on our side running around saying that dead-eyed John Roberts and the rest and the rats and Kennedy that they did not have the right to make that ruling? Because see, that's what these right wingers, whether it be pastor, brother, governor, diabetes, patent oil, snake oil salesman, Mike Huckabee is saying, and that's what Judge Roy Moore is saying, that the Supreme Court of the United States does not even have the right to answer this question. That it does not have the right, the ability, to determine whether or not laws passed in the several bigoted states are noxious to the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. When quite obviously they do. But none of us are saying that the Roberts Court didn't have the right to rule in Citizens United. We're saying that they, as the Supreme Court has such a long history of doing, got it wrong. They just got it wrong. And it's another one of those things that'll have to be fixed somewhere down the road after, Sammy Bad Breath Alito and Fat Tony Scalia and Clarence Coke Can Thomas shuffle off this mortal coil and go to their long homes. That is the difference. The theocratic crybabies are saying that the court can't even make the decision. We're saying we just hope they get it right. But we also acknowledge there's every possibility in the world that they will get it wrong. Like they got Bush v. Gore wrong. Mm-hmm. Like they got Hobby Lobby wrong. Like they got Citizens United wrong. Like they got Sweet Granny... Sweet Granny McFetus up in Massachusetts, wrong. But that's not enough for these goons, because they don't want to live in that world. They want to live in a world where whatever they say, whatever they hate, is the law of the land. Jim with a question, he says, what about the essential role of the Supreme Court and the right of judicial review? Well, that's kind of what I'm getting at relative to Marbury versus Madison. Marbury versus Madison, Justice Marshall says, we're going to be the final word on what the Constitution means and whether or not the workings and doings of the Congress and the President run afoul of it. That's judicial review. That when another branch of the government does something, if a suit is filed and it's timely filed and it's justiciable and there's standing and there's a case and controversy, that the Supreme Court will weigh in and say yay or nay. Well, these nullification secessionists say otherwise. Oh, wait. Hockey puck. Hockey puck. You're going to want the hockey puck for this. Because it's going to get worse. It really is. We got another 2 minutes of this, which may take us somewhere around the halfway mark of the program, the way I work.
The full state goes back to the state's constitution, and you can find nowhere in there marriage. The 10th Amendment says the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. Nor
now, see, he is drunk. The United States by the Constitution. This is like 2 degrees of separation from Red Skelton and the Guzzler's Gin bit. Because the Marriage Amendment is the 10th Amendment says the things not given to the delegate of the Congress is delegated unto the states. It's a marriage. And if your marriage laws turn out to be offensive to the Constitution, what then, Judge? Well, Jesus.
Prohibited by it, the Constitution, to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or the people. We're sworn to the Constitution of the United States. Every state is.
Right.
And that says in the 10th Amendment that they simply don't have this power.
But they're taking that power.
They're taking that power, and as Bowers Court said, if they try to redefine the fundamental of rights, the fundamental rights or category of rights deemed to be fundamental is the way they put it, the judiciary necessarily takes to itself further authority to govern the country without express constitutional authority. And we have justices on the Supreme Court right now.
Oh, dear. I mean, bite down on the hockey puck, okay?
Who have actually performed same-sex marriages, Ginsburg and Kagan. In fact, just last weekend...
Really? Really? Did they eat homosexual wedding cake afterward, too, also? Woo! Oh, my goodness! The flag is a-falling! Somebody... Oh, somebody pick up the flag and carry it home to old Virginia! They done performed the homosexual weddings... See, the theory being that by performing a wedding for a pair of gay people, that Justices Kagan and the notorious RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that they have somehow stricken their neutrality in the case. What you will not hear mentioned, probably, is Justice Roy Moore mentioning the fact that, well, you know, Fat Tony Scalia didn't recuse himself after he'd been out duck hunting with Richard B. Big-time Dick Cheney before he dicks you. That Fat Tony Scalia said, this ain't going to do nothing with regard to my neutrality. I'm going to rule for Dick Cheney whether I go hunting with him or not. Because otherwise he'll shoot me in the face. Why? Well, because Judge Roy Moore is a treasonous hypocrite, that's why.
Ginsburg performed a same-sex marriage, and when she did, it was pointed out by the New York Times that she subtly, or they said slyly, with, I'll quote what the New York Times says, With a sly look and a special emphasis on the word Constitution, Justice Ginsburg said she was pronouncing the two men married by the powers vested in her by the Constitution of the United States. Now, she's commenting on a case.
No, she wasn't, Roy, you freaking moron. I know, that was yesterday. You Titanic twit. Okay, I'm going to go back. Consider these words again.
And a special emphasis on the word Constitution, Justice Ginsburg said she was pronouncing the two men married by the powers vested in her by the Constitution of the United States.
And you know what? She was. She really, really was. Woo, impeach her! No. She was performing a marriage ceremony because she is a Supreme Court justice. And Supreme Court justices are empowered to do judicial things by the Constitution of the United States. Because she's a Supreme Court justice. Now, see, if she was batshit, crazy, treasonous, nullificationist Roy Moore, and she'd been performing a wedding ceremony, I'm sure he's, by the powers vested in me by the state of Alabama. Well, the state of Alabama is the Constitution of the state of Alabama. Not the voters of the state of Alabama. They voted him in. But then he is empowered. He is enabled by the Constitution. Now, this treasonous little numbnuts is trying to say is that she was somehow saying that the Constitution contains the word merge. But it doesn't. It doesn't. It does contain the phrase equal protection of the law. Beep.
Now, she's commenting on a case.
No, she wasn't, you damn liar.
Which is before her and under judicial ethics.
Oh, this is going to be fun. Under the judicial ethics. Well, this is one human being who should probably, and I use the term human being loosely in Roy Moore's case, this is one human being who should probably not be commenting on judicial ethics, as he hath none. This is a guy who put the Ten Commandments, a great big Ten Commandments rock, because great big Ten Commandments rocks are very important in judicial settings, because that lets everybody who doesn't believe in the Ten Commandments know that they are, when they come through the door, if they're not Ten Commandments people, they ain't church people. And it's important. It's important to do that when you're a theocrat. You know, when you're a mullah wannabe. But he did. He put the great big stupid Ten Commandments rock, and he was ordered by the federal courts to move it, and he said, ain't gonna do it! And he got his ass removed from the bench for it. But, you know, whatever you wish to say about these ridiculous fundies, say this, they don't take no for an answer. It's their way or the highway. You know, this is the great-great-grandson of a man who was willing to, you know, whether he marched as a private or a colonel or any other treasonous foolhardiness that was the Confederate Army, was willing to go to war rather than to accept the law of the land. So he wants Ruth Bader Ginsburg impeached. I want this son of a bitch tried for treason. And by God, the word treason is in the Constitution, you foul old prick.
Of federal judges, she can't do that. Congress should do something about this. When a judge in their face, because I know that at least one motion for recusal has been filed against these justices.
Yeah, but here's something funny. You can move to recuse till hell freezes over, but just as in the case of Fat Tony Scalia, son of the Mussolini Fan Club of America's president back during the years before the Second World War, somebody filed a motion about that, trying to get Fat Tony to recuse himself in the case he was going to hear over whether or not Richard B., big-time Dick Cheney before he dicks you, was involved in, and see, nobody can make a Supreme Court justice do nothing. Nobody. There's no judicial review board for the ethical conduct of the Supreme Court. None. And point of fact, the people on the so-called liberal side of the court, which I would argue there's no liberal side of the court, are more prone to recuse themselves. Elena Kagan has recused herself from cases. Sonia Sotomayor has recused herself from cases. And probably anyone, whether it be Kagan, Sotomayor, or Justice Ginsburg, they have more ethics in their toenail clippings than exist in the entire corporate beings, and I do mean corporate beings, of the Rats and Kennedy. And by the way, in case you were wondering, Monsanto's had cases before the Supreme Court, and Clarence Coke Can Thomas, he had been a lawyer for Monsanto and didn't see that as an ethical problem. Nah.
Foundation for Moral Law in Montgomery, Alabama, and they filed an addendum to that recusal motion yesterday.
The Foundation for Moral Law. That's practically a treasonous statement by itself. Moral law is interpreted as meaning God's law, which is interpreted as meaning their God's law, no others need apply. Can you imagine what an uproar there would be in Montgomery, Alabama, if there was a foundation for Sharia law there? What? Me? Sam Heller? Well, it's moral law, folks. Yeah, but it's all the law and stuff and Sharia. It is the of moral law under by the Muslim faith.
Oh, ow!
One of these days, the goddess of irony is going to catch up with Roy Moore, and it's not going to be pretty. It's going to make this whole Duggar business look like Sunday in the park. I mean, this is a guy who is well on the way to being caught trolling for rent boys in the Walmart parking lot in a rented Enterprise rent-a-car van or something. Yeah.
She is doing it in face of plain evidence that she's violating the ethical rules set for federal judges.
The danger here, Chief Justice Moore, what we see unfolding, I think people need to understand this beyond where they stand on this issue of marriage or any other issue, is that this is undermining the rule of law in our country and ushers in an age of chaos.
Rule of law! Rule of law! We don't like something, so we're going to say the judges is making rule of law.
You know, if you really want a good gumbo, you do have to start with a good rule. But it's not a rule of law. It's just rule of good cooking. Just saying.
That's exactly right. And Justice Ginsburg has also been on record as saying our Constitution is old and outdated. And it's old and outdated because people are not obeying it and recognize its limitations on power.
No, dumbass. It's old and outdated because the language is actually still in the document about people of color being four-fifths of a human. That's old and outdated. You could probably make an argument that the Fourth Amendment is old and outdated because we live in an electronic communication age in which people have more than their persons, papers, and effects. They have electrons. Does a person have a right to be secure in their electrons, their packets, their streams? Of course it's old and outdated. It was written in 1787, you freak. I think you can relax your bite on the hockey puck now. There's not much left.
One of those persons is Justice Ginsburg. She is actually commenting on a case that is the same issue that is before her, the constitutionality, fell non, of same-sex marriage. and she's pronouncing a marriage by saying under the authority of the Constitution she's doing this. It is what it is.
Which is not what you say it is. Titanic Tuesdays can be difficult.
Congress has a responsibility to act.
That's right. If Congress is going to let these justices disobey the Constitution they're sworn to uphold, then Congress has a check and a balance. It's called impeachment.
And there you have it. Roy Moore wants Justice Ginsburg impeached, but he never uttered so much as the teeniest, tiniest little peep over the conflicts of interest that plague people like Clarence Coke Can Thomas and Fat Tony Scalia. Let it go now. Letting everything go. Ick. So we'll take a little top of the hour break here into the filibobster, and then we will come to your phone calls if you care to make them. 304-574-8178 is one number. The other number, of course, is the Stress Line, named henceforward in honor of Bill, Mr. Stress Miller. The Stress Line is 304-663-4676, and your calls thereto are most welcome. This is Conversation Radio. We are trying to raise $195 this evening, as we try to raise $200 every evening. That's how we stay on the air. I'm Bob Kincaid. We don't need. You'll forgive me if I think that was a rather inspired choice of a bumper. Bob Marley and the Wailers, No More Trouble. See what I did there? No More Trouble. Roy Moore. But really, really, this is a dangerous bunch. And they are secessionists, and they are nullificationists, and they are they have hearts that beat with treason, and we don't need no more of that trouble. Once, 155 years ago, was more than enough. Let's run over to the stress line, where I suspect we have Kevin. Is that you, Kevin?
Yes, that is me.
How in the world are you?
Oh, doing okay. Listening to your opening tonight. Follow my logic here and see. Tell me if I'm correct in my thinking.
Okay.
Listen, Mr. Moore, and I refuse to call him Judge because he's
damn sure not Justice, right?
Right, exactly. But if the Supreme Court has no standing to rule on what they're talking about, then by their logic, that would follow to each individual state and that state's constitution and laws. And if that is the case, the way I see it, we are no longer the 50 United States of America.
Because we're 50 disunited states. And
we would be, literally, we'd be 50 individual states.
We would be a confederation and not a union.
Right. But it could go farther than that, because now, if the Supreme Court has no standing to rule on matters of the Constitution, each individual state could therefore make, break, create their own treaties, etc., with any of the other 49 states or any other country in the world. Is that going too far in saying that?
No, because you've really, really put the light where it needs to be, Kevin. If the Supreme Court's rulings can be overruled by every other Supreme Court in the United States, the Supreme Court has effectively been nullified.
Exactly.
Its rulings are meaneless.
Yep.
Because if the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court's rulings can be overruled by the various legislatures and Supreme Courts of the several states, then what's to stop them from, what's to stop, say, Alabama Stan or Arkansas Stan or Tennessee Stan or Mississippi Stan? What's to stop them from going back and overruling, say, Brown versus Board of Education? Because you know what? They made it abundantly clear when that decision came out that they damn sure disagreed with it because it took the United States military to enforce it.
Yep.
Sorry, not yelling at you.
I know. Yeah.
But that's the very heart of it. This is the nasty little cancerous knot that is nullification.
Yep.
And it is sufficient to absolutely destroy this country.
Yep. I don't think they'll be satisfied until we have another hot civil war. I think that's where they're headed. I think the only thing that can stop it.
Well, the dumb bastards think they can win this time, because they got guns.
Well, what they think is far removed from reality, because world events won't allow us, I don't think, to get to that point. I think world events will sweep these idiots away with the rest of us long before we go back to a hot civil war, although we've seen it in other countries where things have fallen apart. Bosnia, Herzegovina, Russia. I mean, we've seen this act before play out in other countries. And why our country refuses to learn from history kind of escapes me because,
Well, a couple of observations, Kevin. One, back before the Civil War, I don't want it to be the first Civil War. Back before the Civil War broke out, a man named William Tecumseh Sherman, who was serving as the president or provost or head whatever of an institution of learning in Louisiana, heard all the secession talk, and he said, "You people are out of your cotton-picking minds."
Yep.
He said, "You have no industry, you don't have nearly the population, and you will be blockaded, and you will lose." And he kept talking that reality even after the war broke out, and for a while they seconded his ass over to a mental institution because he said it was going to be a long and bloody and filthy war. Well, he's got to be crazy, but he wasn't.
Nope.
And he for all the scorn that the South heaps upon him, he was one of the more clear-headed, and wouldn't Bill have loved this conversation, he was one of the more clear-headed officers of the upper echelons of the Union Army. And that's why he sought the power to do what he did, and that was to, you know, just stick a knife in the South and twist it until the South squealed uncle. And that is precisely what he did when he marched from Atlanta to the sea. And he showed the South that, you know what I can do when I get to the sea? I can turn around, march right back, and I'll just zigzag the South and just leave paths of destruction until you freaks come to your treasonous minds. Now, that was observation number one. Observation number two, and this actually scares me because I've heard this voiced on this program. I've seen it in the chat room. I've seen it all over the Internet among progressives, liberals. Well, hail. Probably the wrong accent, but, you know, I'm me. Just let them go this time. Really, it wouldn't be worth a war. Just let them go. Let them secede. Yep. Don't just let them secede. Encourage them to secede. Get out. Go on. God love you. And in point of fact, that argument was also made, you know, 1859, 1860. People from Massachusetts were hollering, "They want to go? Let them go." Not understanding that having two nations where once there was one is a recipe for wholesale disaster.
Sure.
Lincoln struggled to keep the Union intact because he understood that if it broke up, then it would become easy pickings for the monomaniacal monarchies of Europe. That and you know that's why so many efforts were made, so many dire efforts were made to make sure that the British did not come in on the side of the South, because the UK, while it had abandoned and banned slavery, was more than happy to have the goods that were produced by the slaves. Their morality about slavery didn't extend that far.
Sure.
And a balkanized United States would be forever at each other's throats. Because one part of the balkanized United States would be comprised of a bunch of eat, pray, fight, fuck Scots, Irish, Southerners.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, Kevin, but I think it's a very real possibility.
Sure. And even more dangerous today than it would have been back then. Because I don't think the Southerners realize we've been pretty blessed to have a country to our north and our south that we haven't had to go to war with in 150 plus years. You know, we had the war with Mexico, but that was more our doing than Mexico's doing. And we haven't had to go to war with Canada since we're, you know, 1776 or whatever. I mean, 1812 at the latest, if you want to go there. But we've been pretty blessed. We, you know, until 9/11 broke out, we never worried about anybody coming across the border from Canada.
Well, we kind of did. I mean, we took the external threat quite seriously during the Second World War, and some half-hearted attempts were made. I mean, German submarines were sighted off the coast of the eastern coast of the United States. The Japanese tried a couple of times, but in neither case did they have the resources to make anything stick. And in point of fact, with regard to the 11th day of September 2001, Kevin, they don't have any power to make anything stick either. The only way, if this country is a union, the only way to take it down is either thermonuclear warfare or to get us to kill ourselves.
And I would say any country in the world that wants to do that doesn't have to work very hard at it, because we got a group of people in this country that's working toward that each and every day, as you just heard on the program. I mean, when you got a guy like Moore, Judge Moore, and Mike Huckabee talking the crap they're talking, Russia doesn't have to work very hard at doing anything to us. China doesn't have to work very hard. The Muslims don't have to work very hard. You know? I mean, and what you're saying is true there, because even though we had 9/11, you know, that's all they're capable of, is the terrorist attack. They don't have the resources to go to war with us other than that. And yet, these people from the South, I truly believe they think, like you just said, they think they can win this time. And it wouldn't. It probably would take a while to get control of the situation if they decided to do that. But how long do you think it would realistically take before the same thing that happened in the 1860s happened to the South again? The blockades, the lack of resources.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because I just had a note from Ron who said, not to sound paranoid or anything, but if I was commander-in-chief or chairman of the Joint Chiefs, I'd move all nuclear weapons, leading-edge weapons, drones, stealth fighters, etc., and smart senior staff out of the stand states, just in case, you know?
Yep. Sure. What do you think they're so paranoid about? Jade Helm, 2015, Obama's supposedly going to attack Texas.
Secret wall, abandoned Walmart, tunnel-connected invasion centers.
Yeah. You know, it's not the president that's paranoid, it's these people that are paranoid. And, you know, if you're paranoid like that long enough, don't you create your own reality?
Haven't they already?
Exactly. You know, and...
You know, I wonder, and I'm not trying to be a dick here, Kevin, I wonder if maybe the flooding has maybe taken their eyes, mind off of Jade Helm, or was that, did that one in their White House cause all the flooding with his secret chemtrail homo ray?
Well, I mean,
he's already turned Jamaica and Ireland gay.
Yeah, well,
you think maybe
I haven't
he couldn't
heard
remember? And we all know from past learning, Kevin, that homosexuals have tremendous powers over the natural forces of Earth.
Sure.
Because they've been cited as being able to start earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes, you know, then, you know, some a couple of thousand year floods should be no big deal in Texas.
Well, I haven't heard anyone mention yet, oddly enough, about how God's punishing Texas. You know.
That becomes problematic, because we can say, well, you know, God's punishing Texas for denying the climate change that we created on his planet.
Sure.
But the Texans, the God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical fundamentalists, would say, no, he's punishing Texas for staying in the United States and not seceding like Jimmy Dick Perry said we ought to.
Yep. Well, I don't know. What to say other than that. It just occurred to me that if we follow this logic of theirs, quotes around logic, you know, this is what's going to happen. Maybe we can call ourselves the Walking States of America when it's all over with. And just, you know.
But if, well, the other possibility that I acknowledge, and I don't know how far out this would be. And far out being, you know, far out, man, meaning that, but also meaning how far out in time. I think that it is entirely possible that if it happens to this country again, the really viable possibility of secession would be the Pacific Coast.
Yep.
Maybe as far inland as New Mexico and you know, Utah, Nevada. Well, maybe not Utah. Who'd want them? No offense to our friends in Utah, but, I mean, really, well, I don't know. The Californians have to have somewhere to go skiing. But that's a much more real possibility. Because the economies of California, Oregon, and Washington, taken together, are considerably larger than most countries.
Sure.
And they've got a sufficient population to put up a military. And they've already got the infrastructure. But then again, I also don't... But in order to talk secession, you have to have, and it's an essential element, Kevin, you have to have treason beating in your heart. And I don't think treason beats in the heart of the average Californian like it does in the heart of the average South Carolinian or Alabamian.
No. And then I'd warn the people talking secession, next time there's not going to be a Lincoln there holding a Sherman back from just making sure it doesn't happen again. Lincoln made sure that the South wouldn't be repaid in kind. He wanted to see the South come back.
With malice toward none, with charity for all.
Right. Right. That ain't going to happen next time.
And look what he got for his troubles.
Exactly. And I hate to say it, but I almost think Lincoln made a mistake. I hate to say that, but looking forward in
history... Well, we're still dealing with the problem. After he was killed, all ideas of Reconstruction and putting freed African American citizens equal citizenship footing, that all went out the door. A terrorist campaign run in the South by people like Nathan Bedford Forrest and the Klan destroyed Reconstruction. They passed Posse Comitatus so that the American military, you know, people point to Posse Comitatus as some sort of good thing. It's like, well, look, the military can't be used to be police in America. Well, Posse Comitatus was passed in order to get rid of Reconstruction and prevent freed black people from achieving actual meaningful freedom. Okay?
Yep.
So we are dealing with the aftermath of all of that. And it all has to do with the fact that we didn't do anything about the traitors.
Sure.
Some Confederate generals, who was it, Longstreet? Longstreet went on to become a fabulously wealthy railroad executive, didn't he?
Yep.
I mean, he was invited back into the capitalist enterprise that is the United States with open freaking arms.
Well, even Robert E. Lee got to retire. You know, the man was not executed for his crimes, and you know, so how many people were executed after that war was over for their role in it? I can't think of one offhand. I'm sure there must have been someone, but, you know.
Thinking about it, I'm not sure that I can come up with one either.
Jefferson Davis? What happened to Jefferson Davis?
Lived to a ripe old age. His descendants,
exactly.
His descendants still curse the land to this day when there's not a descendant of Abraham Lincoln alive.
Yep. I won't be around to see it, but I tell you what, if they're thinking that it's going to be a fun thing to go through again and life is just going to be great being the Confederate States of America this time, they're going to be sadly mistaken, because number one, whoever the president is, even a teabagger, well, I shouldn't say teabagger, even a Republican president wouldn't allow it for one reason, because money. But they ain't going to be so amiable toward a peace without taking care of those who betrayed this country. And I don't think people like, well, I know they don't. People like Huckabee and Moore do not even think about it, because the possibility of failure, just like any psychopath, the possibility of failure does not exist in their minds. You know, they cannot see any way this could turn out to be anything but good for their side. And that's what's scary about it, because in their own Bible, I believe Jesus talked about, before a general goes to war, doesn't he think about what the cost will be? You know, do I really want to go to war? You know, and not these people. And that's the logic that they're being driven by. And I don't know what the solution is, but I, you know, that brings me to this one thing you said, talking about how our side sees decisions by the Supreme Court. Our side isn't being all that vocal compared to their side when talk like this comes up. I haven't heard a whole lot of criticism from our side when someone like Roy Moore speaks out with obvious nonsense about what he's been talking, what you played on the program today. And, you know, but then again, who's really on our side? You know, I see guys like Sanders and Warren. I wouldn't include Hillary in that, in the sense that, you know, I see her more as a corporatist dim than anything else. And so, you know, she may disagree with people like Warren, Huckabee, but she's not going to come out and really slam them, at least not until the election of 2016 is decided, because it might lose her vote, you know. And that I consider to be a failing of our democracy, where politicians are more concerned about votes than about what's right or wrong. So, but I really don't know what the solution is, other than to keep pointing it out for what it is. So,
and
that's all I.
Yeah, I'm not trying to make anybody think that something is imminent, but I don't think I'm being unfair if I suggest that the other side would not mind if it was. By the way, I had a note from Ron in Raleigh, Kevin. I was thinking the same thing. As far as post-Civil War executions, Ron points out that, yes, the commandant of Andersonville prisoner of war camp was executed. And rightfully so. But the commandant of Andersonville was not nearly as responsible for nearly as many deaths as, say, Robert E. Lee.
Yep.
Or, in point of fact, Jefferson Davis, Judah P. Benjamin, Alexander Stevens. But remember, in the final analysis, those and the government, the Congress, has ever been this way. Alexander Stevens, Jefferson Davis. Those weren't traitors. Those were former colleagues. Those were senators. Yep. You know, Jefferson Davis was a respected member of the United States Senate In point of fact, wielding enough power. He was Secretary of War at one point, I think.
Yep.
And he was the one, and I mentioned this several years ago, there is a statue of liberty. Not the Statue of Liberty, but there's another Statue of Liberty that crowns the dome of the United States Capitol. And she wears this really goofy-ass headdress, turkey feathers and shit.
Yeah.
When she was originally designed, she was wearing what was called at the time a liberty cap, a cap of liberty, which had become fashionable in revolutionary France. It was Jefferson Davis who stopped that, who said, "It is an insult for a symbol of a free people to be wearing a cap of liberty." When, in point of fact, what Jefferson Davis was worried about was the fact that there were a whole lot of people born in America who were not wearing any liberty caps and significantly outnumbered the white folks in the South and might get a hankering to put one of those suckers on and slit the throat of old Marse in the night.
Yep.
Because, you see, race fear permeates and percolates through the entirety of white Southern culture.
Oh, yeah.
From the very first moment that slaves were kidnapped and imported into this country, race fear has dominated white thinking in the South. Because they knew, Kevin, they knew how evil that institution was. But regardless of how evil it was, they also recognized that a few of them were getting really, really, really rich off of it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Bernie Sanders a minute ago. Bernie just made it real. Of course, he may have significantly harmed his chances, but the man is... You know, if you meet Bernie is not going to come across, because I've met him, Bernie doesn't come across as somebody he will never win the "I'd like to drink a beer with that guy" contest. He's kind of rough around the edges. He's short. I don't mean in stature. I mean, you know, he's that New England kind of say what you mean what you say, get on with it kind of people. And he announced, and I don't think he's going to lie to the American people.
No.
And so today, he said straight out that he would be willing to back a 90% top marginal tax rate on the super rich. You know, like the United States had back when it was at its absolutely most prosperous and successful.
Yep. Oh, I can imagine that they're in a bit of an uproar over that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, this all came as part of an interview on CNBC with John Harwood. And, of course, CNBC is right-wing, right-wing, right-wing. Yep. Remember, it was some asshat at CNBC who got the whole teabagging thing going.
Yep.
Taxed enough already! And I've got the clip here, so when we ring off here, I'll run it just so people can hear what Bernie says about how, you know, what should happen to close the gap on income inequality.
It would only make sense. I mean, you know. Just like you said, when we were most prosperous, that was what was happening. And someone who is a billionaire can afford to pay a higher tax than you or I can.
And never miss a nickel of it.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. All right, well, let's check out this clip, and we will talk soon. Kevin, I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
All right, have a good evening.
See you later, Bob.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All Our buddy Kevin calling from Colorado. Let's check in here with John Harwood and Bernie Sanders. It's a fairly brief clip, and then I'll go over to the Skype line. The stress line is now open if you want to get involved in the conversation.
People on Wall Street, people in business, some have even likened the progressive/democratic crusade to Hitler's Germany hunting down the Jews. What do you think when you hear stuff like that?
It's sick. And I think these people are so greedy. They're so out of touch with reality. They think they own the world. And the idea that anybody like me or anybody else are challenging them and saying, maybe, just maybe, there's something wrong when 99% of all new income goes to the top 1%. Oh, this is Hitlerism? That you suggest that? What a disgusting remark. If you have seen a massive transfer of wealth from the middle class to the top 1/10%, you know what? You've got to transfer that back. Radical socialist Dwight D. Eisenhower was president. I think the highest marginal tax rate was something like 90.
It was 90. When you think about 90%, you don't think that's obviously too high.
No. What I think is obscene, and what frightens me is, again, when you have the top 1/10 of 1% owning almost as much wealth as the bottom 90. Does anybody think that that is the kind of economy this country should have? We think it's moral. You got people not working one job, they're working two jobs, three jobs. People scared to death about what happens tomorrow. Half the people in America have less than $10,000 in savings.
Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton in the last 16 months have made $30 million making speeches. What is that kind of...
Oh, Jesus, really, Harwood? This is a charming little setting, by the way. They're sitting having spaghetti and meatballs in some restaurant somewhere, and Bernie's sitting there talking with his... chewing and talking at the same time. The guy is real. He is unmistakably real. You know, Marty says, hell, I'd share a picture of Sam Adams with Bernie. I bet he'd be fun to sit at a bar and have that freewheeling conversation. Yeah, but he's not. I guess what I'm getting at is that he's not gonna work around. He's not gonna be like a pitcher who paints the edges. I can use a baseball metaphor with Marty because Marty gets it. You know, being a Giants fan and everything. He's not going to paint the edges. He's going to throw 102 miles an hour right down the middle of the plate and challenge it. And if you can't hit it, it ain't his fault. You can't hit what you can't see. But no, there's the for-profit damn media again. Hillary, oh, is Hillary making too much money? Do you want to take all of Hillary's money? Hitler. And I can't hear questions like that without, and I don't want to piss anybody off. But I always think of, you know, the people who consider themselves the far left, and you know, arguably I'm that guy. You don't get much more left than me. But you know, we got those people out there, Hillary, who lose their freaking little left wing minds. Hillary. You know, they're like one neuron away from Benghazi. Email. Speechifying. So I don't know. Did the producer? Did the Mucky Mucks? I mean, the CEO. Who told? Hey, John Harwood, make sure you get in a couple of Hillary questions sooner or later. I mean, Bernie's really got to hate her. I mean, sooner or later, I mean, maybe if the meatballs are really good, he'll say something nasty about her. And then won't that be really cool? And we'll have that personality conflict that's the only way we in the for-profit media can ever understand politics. As soap opera. Not as policy. Not as theory. Not as social concern. But as soap opera. So you know, ask the Hitlery question, would you? Would you, Harwood?
Not working one job, they're working two jobs, three jobs. People scared to death about what happens tomorrow. Half the people in America have less than $10,000 in savings.
Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton in the last 16 months have made $30 million making speeches. What does that kind of money do to a politician's perspective on the struggles you were just talking about?
I mean, theoretically, you could be a multi-billionaire and, in fact, be very concerned about the issues of working people. Theoretically, that's true. When you hustle money like that, You don't sit in restaurants like this. You sit in restaurants where you spend, I don't know what they spend, hundreds of dollars for dinner and so forth. That's the world that you're accustomed to, and that's the worldview that you adopt. I'm not going to condemn Hillary and Bill Clinton because they've made a lot of money. That type of wealth can, you know, has the potential to isolate you from the reality of the world.
You and I talked some months ago.
No. Barney, you ain't getting it. Barney, cut! No, Barney, you have to say something really nasty about her. Like, you know, how she shouldn't be president because money. Okay, take two. Roll it.
When you said you were going to take a look at running and you weren't going to do it if it was a fool's errand, if it wasn't viable.
Yes.
What did you see that made you think that it was viable?
That's a good question.
There is more discontent and more anger at the establishment, that is, the corporate establishment, the political establishment, the media establishment, if you like.
Is Hillary Clinton the establishment?
Oh, I think it's...
So... What is he got an IFB in his ear with some screeching producer going, we gotta get the soap opera going here. This could be big for you, Harwood.
Hard not to acknowledge that Hillary Clinton is part of the establishment. That's hard not to acknowledge.
I've heard a lot of Democrats say, it's great that Bernie's running. Of course he won't win the nomination. I wonder if you have any idea that you're, in the end, going to be seen as this giant cruise ship is rolling by and you're in a paddle boat yelling after it and not making an impact.
John, let me say this. I fully concede that I get into this race as a major underdog. No question. As I've said before, though, don't underestimate me. I think we're going to do better than people think, and I think we've got a shot to win this thing.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us.
John, thank you.
Enjoy it.
Oh, Hillary questions. Can I? Because, see, let me see before everybody goes, he loves Hillary. No, I'm supporting Senator Sanders. I'm supporting Senator Sanders, and I'm going to support Senator Sanders in a positive manner because I think he has policy answers that Secretary Senator Clinton doesn't have. I think she is closer to the establishment than Senator Sanders is. But I also acknowledge that if Senator Sanders was to become President of the United States, he would, by definition, be part of the establishment. Can we agree on that? I mean, he's not going to fart little sparkle pony unicorns out his butt on January the 20th, 2017, if he becomes president. It's not going to happen. And, you know, the talk of Bill and Hillary making that kind of money. I haven't seen any campaign announcements from Bill Clinton. How much of that was Bill and how much of it was Hillary? Why aren't you talking about the money Hillary made instead of Hillary and Bill? I mean, they're not, if she wins the election in 2016, they are not going to be co-inaugurated. So there's the question. Why did Harwood not ask any questions about Ted Cruz or Koch brothers darling Scott Walker or Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, and that thing on his head? Why no questions about Marco Rubio, who says if gay people can get married, Christians are going to be tortured in the streets? Why no questions about pastor, brother, governor, diabetes, patent medicine, snake oil salesman Mike Huckabee? Because they have to have a soap opera. They have to be hollering about, they have to be able to holler about what's going to happen down to the armory on Saturday night when the Red Marvel takes on the Blue Demon. And then, of course, yeah. Of course, he's not a serious candidate. He's going to get trounced by Senator Clinton. Keep saying that. And hopefully
the Clinton camp will believe that too. Was it our buddy Lee Potter the other night, a week or so ago, who said that, who said, I believe in upsets, and referenced Appalachian State beating the University of Michigan? Yeah, me too. Irish Dave pointing out, Bernie Sanders, just like Barry Conner, ain't no serious candidate because he just keeps on talking about issues. I mean, what's your favorite beer? Do you wear boxers or briefs, Senator Sanders? That's what America wants to know. Jesus. Let's run over to the Skype line and talk to John. Are you there, John?
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Cynic himself. How are you doing this evening?
I think I'm getting along okay.
Well, just hope you don't get that sweaty spot there sitting naked in the room there. It's just always
yeah, the chair gets a little sticky after a while. It's sweat sticky, damn it. Bunch of perverts.
Yeah. Yeah, it can't take me out back or nothing. But little observation.
Yes.
And kind of dovetailing off of Jim and yourself. The questions that this guy Horowitz asks make absolute perfect sense if you realize that he does not give a damn what Sanders says. The whole point of the whole point of a profit-driven media system is ratings. And you alluded to the answer right there. Ratings. Horse race. Soap opera. Controversy. Scandal. Oh my God. Jesus. Oh, look.
Hey, and I think we've got the perfect title for the soap opera. All My Candidates.
Now see, yeah, All My Candidates. Perfect. You've got what? Damn near, you got almost 20 some odd candidates that are in play. Or near in play, and I've read today where there's another six or seven that are now starting to dip their toe in the water, people you haven't even freaking heard of yet. But here's the trick, and this is my personal opinion. When this guy asks, oh my God, what about, you know, the establishment candidate, but he doesn't say what establishment. The political establishment? They don't really have a lot of power.
Hey, well, John, but in this day and age, I think the political establishment and the corporate establishment are the same establishment.
Yeah, well, I'm nasty enough to actually still cut a line between the two. I mean, you don't have the dogs at the end of the leash saying that they're players. You know.
No, but you let them think they are. You let them think they are.
Yeah. You let them think they are until you have to yank the chain tight one day. I remember I've got a DVD set here of that HBO show, the AC, the Newsroom, and I've watched that first season like four or five times because it dips so deeply into things. And there was a section of that was where, you know, they were talking about Charles and David Koch, and you know. Granted, it's a lefty show, it's a HBO and what have you. It was one of the few places you'll see something like that play. But it brings up and it kind of dimly lights up the fact that, and you see it already. I mean, they're slapping Sanders down. Oh, he's not a viable candidate. He knows he'll never win. Da 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 da. Because he scares the shit out of them. Because let's paint a picture. January 20th, 2017, with an amazing outpouring of and the greatest turnout numbers since Barack Obama's election. President-elect Sanders wins by a narrow margin, but he wins. You could just imagine the shaking of the boots. Scaring. But then the poor guy is going to be up against a House and maybe not a Senate, but definitely a House that's still going to be run by a bunch of right-wing crazy wackos. What's he going to be able to get done? Nothing. He'll have to play the whole executive actions, and that's already causing all kinds of screaming and hollering. I mean, I would like the man to win, and I'm like you. I've tentatively placed my support behind him. But I also am, having been in and around politics in the earlier parts of my career, I almost feel sorry for the guy if he was to win.
Well, okay, let's take a little bit of what you just put forward and run with it. January the 20th, 2017, falls on a Friday. That means on Monday, January the 23rd, if it turned out that Wall Street did not get its way and either a Republican or Secretary Senator Clinton did not win the presidency, if it was to be Senator Sanders, on Monday, January the 23rd, 2017, the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, would open down 5,000 points.
Oh,
because that
probably
would be,
at least 500 or 600, yeah, easy.
That would be... That would be the equivalent of Wall Street walking in and putting a brick through the window and saying, "Nice building you got here. Be a shame if something happened." You know, sometimes buildings burn down. We burned it. You know, remember when we burned the building down in 2008? You know, we could do it again. I mean, it would be terrible if something happened. So, I think that's a possibility. But there will also be a congressional election. I think there's something special about Bernie's candidacy, and maybe it's just wishful thinking on my part. And God knows, I'm seeing all kinds of subtle stuff floating around out there that makes me think that the rat fucking is underway. It's mild right now. If he gets any kind of traction, it will get hyper ugly, hyper fast. But he's not a Democrat in the truest sense of member of the party. Democrat. He's also not a Republican. Which means he can actually talk to both sides of the aisle. He undertook a southern tour in the last couple of years, specifically to talk to people down there that would not turn out to listen to a damn Democrat. Okay?
Yeah.
And he was met with considerable success. This thing can get going. Let me share an anecdote with you. Steve writes in and says, "Bernie's chief of staff was a former union organizer in the psych hospital where I worked. It was a struggle, but we were eventually successful. In his first Senate campaign, I stood to ask a question at one of the debates. Bernie pointed at me and thanked me for my question. He called me by my name, Steve. Bernie crosses demographics and class. If someone wasn't personally helped by Bernie's office, they know people who have." And he's real. He is intensely real. And
yeah.
I think there's a possibility there, because that's one of the things, John. You know, our candidates have become so polished and so packaged and so merchandised and so marketed that there's an outside opportunity for somebody who isn't all that to say, "Look at me, I'm real, and I'm going to talk about real issues, and I'm going to talk about real solutions, and maybe have a chance."
Oh, yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you on that. I mean, that's the great.
I'm not going to damn a potential Sanders presidency by saying he could never get anything done.
Oh, I mean, it's a statement that is. I mean, I'm not saying you can get nothing done, but you have to be realistic. You alluded to it right there with the stock market drop. You know, you love hearing business people who will talk to you about, "Well, that policy is going to cost a lot of jobs." Yeah, because you're going to fire them. You know, in an ownership society like we have, the owners do what they want to do, and they make self-fulfilling prophecies all the time. stock market crash. Oh, that's going to cost jobs because you're going to fire people. It's like this mess they got going on, kind of bouncing off what you were talking about earlier. It's not so much that, say, California is going to succeed from the union, but, I don't have access to my full internet right now, but maybe Carol could pull it up and see. But there is a debate going on in California about busting up into two states. North California and South California are...
That state of Jefferson stuff, I'm very well aware of it, and it's being run by a whole bunch of teabaggers who can't be trusted with their own toenail clippings.
No, I just came out of California about 2 weeks ago, and that was a rather harsh, that was a conversation going on. Not so much state of Jefferson, but there are actual movers and shakers in California that talk about the fact that up around the Northern California, their economy is so different, the people are so different, as versus the more conservative people down in the valley and everything else, that you may talk about it as a Jeffersonian thing, but there's actually somebody made an attempt to the last election cycle or something to try to get a ballot pushed for that.
Yeah, but with referendum and recall in California, I mean, look, there's a guy who's trying to get a ballot initiative to have all the homosexuals taken out and murdered.
Yeah.
That's one of the practical realities of a referendum and recall state is you can have that loopy shit. Because it's democracy at its finest. It's a question of what can you get the mob to do? Democracy is, let us understand it, is for what it is. Democracy is mob rule.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why I'm not a big fan of it, as much as that might distress people. The democracy of a people is only as good as the people.
Well, pure anything is usually dangerous. That's why your moonshine at best is usually 140 proof and not 200, because 200 proof alcohol will kill your ass real quick. Pure democracy is mob rule with no restraints. As I've frequently noted, pure democracy killed Socrates.
Yeah. But you still get the situation where in this country you still got 40% of the population that believe in angels or aliens or whatever.
Well, it's like the other day I was in a Facebook discussion and someone brought up the idea talking about making our country more democratic and brought up the idea of not marriage equality specifically, but gay rights as a function of democracy. It ain't. That's a function. That's a function of social policy. It's a function of it, but it's not democracy. Because a democracy is strict. A pure democracy is strictly majority based.
Yeah, and your gay rights would not get anywhere if it was strictly democracy. At least not up until recently.
Well, the democracy was insufficient to the task of eliminating slavery.
Yeah,
democracy was insufficient to the task of bringing the franchise to women. Democracy was damned well certainly insufficient to the task of granting women autonomy over the workings of their own reproductive systems. All of those things were brought about as a recognition of minority rights. Democracies don't operate that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, don't know how much longer I'll live through it, but the next decade or two is going to be pretty bloody interesting because, a lot of things, and this is my personal opinion, but I think a lot of things that have been percolating out in the sticks, that now that the internet and mass communications are so easy, that stuff's all coming out of the woodwork.
But what you call the sticks, rural parts of the country, are still the heart and soul of right and white wingism and conservatism. Look at the marriage equality vote in Ireland. the 30% who did manage to slither out to the polls and vote against equality, well, they came from the sticks.
Yep.
And they were the uneducated, the uninformed, the bigoted, the people who still clung to church teaching. In other words, stupid people.
Well, I'll tell you, my uncle said something, at, you know, drunken sot that he was, that always kind of rung into my ears, and it's a combination statement that he got on his little, you know, his chomping on his corn cob pipe and pontificated occasionally, probably where I got some of it from. But, you know, these guys, and maybe it's part of the media, but you see all these TV shows, you see all these movies, and I sometimes get a little angry about it. It's mostly because I'm just an emotionally stunted individual, but I do get tired of the constant, and it's not universal, mind you, I'm not being universalist here, but there seems to be a strain in this country that seems to somehow equate city folk as being effete, sensitive, you know, add whatever adjectives you want to it.
Not by me.
Less than, yeah, not by me either, but I hear it all the time. You know, they had a commercial that, not too, you know, New York City, you know, against it, was a Picante or.
That was Pace Picante sauce,
Yeah. Well, that is, in a nutshell, what I hear all the time out here. If you live in concrete and high rises, you're not American. You like the gays.
That's been very carefully cultivated by the right wing. I mean, consider the title of Pastor, Brother, Governor, Diabetes, Snake Oil, Miracle Cure Salesman Mike Huckabee. God, Guns, Grits, and Gravy.
Yeah.
Because, of course, we know that everyone who lives in the cities doesn't eat gravy. They eat sauces.
Yeah. Well, see, to me, that's always, you know, I've always hated that. Because, and here, I'm more
gravy?
I'm getting myself in trouble here. Well, no, I'm saying.
I was going to say,
when
I
you
mean,
get into,
you hate
when
gra-
you get it,
you hate gravy, you're going to have a problem with me.
No, I don't. That's part of the reason why I've got diabetes. That's why I want to put my foot up Huckstery's ass for taking advantage of people like me. But I've seen it almost my entire life. It's this thing where, you know, it was even in my own family. My dad, my God, he moved up to around suburban Washington, D.C. and took family with him because that's where the jobs were. But he came from the rural environment. And the entire time we lived there, he couldn't get along with his neighbors because they were all a bunch of, you know, uppity intellectuals. Oh, he's got a college degree. Well, a college degree what? Finger painting? You know, that ain't nothing. And.
Oh, you remember the old Black Sheep Squadron TV series from way back? And there was that one.
Yeah.
There's that one crusty old mechanic sergeant who said, "Hey, college boy," you know, as if having an education was some, and that is a strain of anti-intellectualism that runs like a mighty river through the history of this country.
Oh
but,
yeah,
but you were talking, well, you were talking about you talking about your daddy moving y'all up, you know, to the city. I can't tell you how many, and you know, you come from a chunk of Virginia that I know about. I can't tell you how many West Virginians there are. Well, I would hazard a guess that with very few exceptions, every West Virginian out there somewhere except West Virginia pines, and that's a word we use around here, you know that, John, pines for home.
Sure.
And they pine for an idealized home, not the home where I live, where it's a 10-mile round trip to the grocery store that's only open till 9 p.m.
Oh, I have some of the most interesting and so and stimulating, well, I'll be polite and call discussions with some of these people I run into at the truck stops and stuff, that They pine for a 1950s, 1960s that, as far as I know, never existed.
Well, there's that, too.
It never existed. The Ozzie Harriet, the whole, you know, Leave It to Beaver, all that mess, never existed. You know, in the days when my dad would actually talk, you know, reality, he'd tell me about those times where, you know, you were lucky if you made $15 a week. And you made do with, you know, the entire number of clothes that you possessed, you could stuff into a single bag, and most of them were threadbare. Because he was born and was raised in the Depression era. You know, in the back end of the Depression era. And it irritates me to sit there and listen to these people and how they long for a time, and then I would bring up, I'd say, okay, well, you long for a time when a significant minority of the population were second-class citizens, when the wife or girlfriend that you have was not much better than a second-class citizen. Do you want to go back to that time? And it's really funny to watch their faces go through these little, like, he's like almost going, yeah, and then he realizes what I'm saying. You could watch his face almost break, trying to put the brakes on what he was about to say. But it's amazing to watch these people. This is what they want. These bastards, Huckabee and all of them, they want to dial it back. You talk about the Islamics wants to go back 14th century. Well, these guys here, they would like nothing more than to dial the world back to 1952. Ideal year for them. Great stuff. Top of the world, no threats.
Yeah, with that 90% top marginal tax rate.
Sure. But except for that, of course. You know that. But
then again, back then, the John Birch Society was calling Eisenhower a communist stooge.
Creep. Well, anywho, I'll let you go. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
And as always.
You're half of that fascinating conversation, John, and I appreciate it.
Only about 30%, actually, because I was a little off my game today. Catch you later.
All right. Take care. Drive safe. Somewhere out on the road, out west, our buddy John. Yeah, see, I don't want to make anybody think that I'm a you know, budding dictator or anything, or want to be maximum Bob for life or whatever. But I get a little uneasy when I hear our side talking all this romantic mishmash about democracy. Because, trust me, they don't want it. Democracy is something that they want because they think that their idea of democracy will result in an expansion of rights and frisbees and wheat checks for everybody. There is not an issue. Let's be clear. Maybe I'm wrong. But I don't think I am. And I don't think there are a lot of people out there doing this sort of broadcasting who will say something as plainly as I'm about to say it. There are not many issues that are important to liberals and progressives that could win on a straight democracy-based vote. Do you think if you put marriage equality on a national ballot, just like what happened in Ireland, do you think the new United States of America, the greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever, would say, well, hell yeah? Because I don't. Do you think if you put Citizens United on a national referendum basis, that Citizens United would go away? Because I don't. Pick any issue that means it. How about a nationwide referendum on the right to organize. You think Ma and Pa Duggar out there in Arkansas would get their churches together to come out and vote in favor of First Amendment freedom of association, which is what it is? Because I don't. Mm-mm. Hey, how about a national referendum removing the tax-exempt status of the churches? I doubt if our side would get 1% of the vote. And maybe that's just the hyper cynical in me. But golly Moses, we've got a whole lot more Titanic intellect out there to celebrate. Note coming in from Steve in China, he says, but how is a man of substance supposed to prevail over the forces and farces of personality, celebrity, caricature, and spectacle? I don't see it. And man, I hope to hell I'm wrong. When money is free speech, corporations are people, may as well just keep munching your popcorn. Yeah. My real world experiences with so-called true democracy, In small group settings even, they're not positive. Because my experiences with that come from so-called consensus-based decision-making. And, you know, that's the one where Treebeard and Celery are sitting in the meeting. And, maybe there's 60 people in the meeting, whatever. It's not an unmanageable number. But you'll have consensus-based decision-making going on, and a question will be before the group, and everybody is on stack, and we're keeping a careful list of who wants to talk, and everybody's trying to be sensitive to and cognizant of issues of privilege, whether it be race privilege, gender privilege, economic privilege, everybody, right? And then Treebeard puts up his hand, and it's Treebeard's turn on stack. And he says, well, you know, I mean, I'm not throwing a block here. I just have some concerns. I mean, I'm just concerned about what we're discussing here. And while I'm not blocking, definitely not blocking. And we'll continue to talk for 2 hours. And completely subvert the democratic process. By an exercise of passive aggression. Has that spoiled me on some notions of democracy? Probably. But I would dare say a bunch of you have been in those kinds of meetings. It ain't just me. Sat in a meeting one time where someone said, oh, again, Treebeard, or maybe this one was Celery, I'm not going to participate in any meeting that is based on Robert's Rules of Order because, you know, like, Robert's Rules of Order are oppressive and, like, they oppress people who haven't read Robert's Rules of Order and they're all full of, like, privilege from people who read things. Okay. Really happened. Note coming in from the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas Stan. Subject, anti-intellectual America. That's America with a K. As you may know, Alexis de Tocqueville identified an anti-intellectual strain in America, and Richard Hofstadter wrote about it much later. I suppose that is one reason the right wing thinks that going after teachers will work. Yes, because it does. There's a reason that the right wing fosters anti-intellectual stupid pride. See, this is one of those times when German compound nouns would come in really handy in English. I just made one right there. Stupid pride. it's, but it doesn't capture everything that I'm quite after. It's being stupid and being proud of it to the point of being dismissive of people who aren't. Now, that's a compound noun. But this country's awash in it. Greatest country in the world on earth now, today, forever. I mean, even that stupid little phrase is a manifestation of that. Seven years of right-wingers hooting about socialism. You know, the socialism that's being practiced by the friend of Wall Street that is Barack Obama. You sort it out, because... Oh, what a word! Did you just come up with that? Is that one of, is that yours, Devin? Ignorarrogance. Woo! Oh, wait. Damn, that's what we got this for. And a toaster. Ignorarrogance. Write that one down. Get it on a t-shirt. Call the friends and neighbors. You just diagnosed it. I mean... Send Devin's name to fucking to Norway for the wherever, Sweden, I don't know. Norway, isn't it? The Nobels? This year's Nobel Prize in Political Science goes to Devin in the Quiet Zone for discovering the American political principle of ignorarrogance. Whoop! I'm keeping that one. I'm going to put that under glass on the family mantle. I swear to God, ignorarrogance. Meanwhile, Carol says, in regard to the meetings, okay, good. I'm glad to know I'm not the only one who's... No, no bell, damn it. Not a Peabody. Don't settle, Devin. You want a Nobel. Carol says, I usually make a motion to throat punch people who do that shit during meetings. It always gets a brisk second. Those are the people who call me a snob, because I can string together multiple cogent thoughts. Ignorarrogance, definition, stupid proud. If you wanted to create an activism around it, what would your chant be? We're dumb, we won't be mum. Titanic Tuesday, a celebration of right-wing ignorarrogance. We done did something here. Both lines are open if you want to get involved in the program. You can jump in at 304-574-8178, or you can come in via the stress line, 304-663-4676. You're more than welcome. Okay, do we have some pushback here? Jay Cruzen says, Bob, have a look at these poll results. Click the top link and see them. Progressive ideas would win. Okay.
Waiting.
Okay. Poll of likely 2016 voters. This is a little complicated. I'm having to open a PDF now. The production machine may catch fire. The Big Ideas Project, a project of the Progressive Ideas Institute, or something like that. Progressive Change Institute. Let's see. National poll of 1,500 likely 2016 voters, Republicans, Independents, Democrats, Kentucky, with GBA strategies on behalf of the Progressive Change Institute. More details on the yada yada. Allow government to negotiate drug prices. Yes. big margin. Give students the same low interest rates as big banks. Yes, universal pre-K kinder. Yeah, this is a list of everything we want as progressives. And take that poll again. And I'm not trying to be an ass here. I guess I just am without even trying. Take that poll again after a few $1 billion of Koch brothers' money have been poured into it. Take that poll again after after the faithful have been in their flockiness hammered over the head with how it's communism and socialism and anti-Christian and God will hate us forever by the gospel sharps standing in their pulpits. I want to believe this kind of stuff. Believe me. That's two beliefs in two sentences for me, which is kind of unusual. That being the case, though, we know how I feel about all that believing. Let's go over to the Skype line and check in with Jim. Hey, Jim.
How are you this evening?
Okay, I think.
Good. Could we change the conversation into other parts of the world? I think that were mentioned in your first caller, tangentially.
We can certainly try.
Well, this business in the Ukraine is certainly something to be concerned about. And I'm not exactly sure where this is going to go.
What did I read earlier today that some exalted Russian military mucky muck or political mucky muck something said that tanks don't need visas.
I'm sorry, Bob. I can barely hear you.
I don't know what to do, but no, some Russian somewhere said tanks don't need visas.
Tanks don't need what? I'm sorry.
Visas.
Oh no, they don't.
Passports.
No, they certainly don't. I think that's been proven many times throughout history. No, they don't. But this business with the well, there's just certain provocations going on over there that are very unhealthy and very dangerous.
We seem to be engaged in we've got us a sharp stick, and we seem to be engaged in poking it at hornet's nests.
I'm afraid you might be right, and I don't like the idea of that type of activity because I went through back in the 80s with things like Able Archer and NATO, and of course NATO making now these snap decisions to commit assets participating in exercises that, well, they're not going to produce anything that's going to be productive, because there's always going to be pushback on those things, you know?
Yes, indeed.
And, of course, you've got this business with China and the South China Sea.
Oh, there's something in me that thinks stuff's going to get really real sometime in the fairly near future. More likely, I will say this. I know that we as progressives and liberals tend to see Barack Obama as far more of a hawk, and we certainly see Hillary Clinton as far more of a hawk than we would prefer. But I will say, I will say with almost unfortunately apt usage of the word dead certainty, that a President Rubio, a President Cruz, a President Scott Cokewalker, a President Huckstery, and possibly even a President Rand Paul and that thing on his head will be much more likely to get us into a mess that we really can't get out of
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And as far as our own constitutional and internal problems of this country are concerned, I think they're going to account very little for the results of that type of activity. Because I do believe the Russian Federation is, well, there's just, they've got some problems over there that they need to resolve themselves without us having military advisors and things like that and 300 boots on the ground or 150 boots on the ground, whichever way you want to count it. I'm not sure how many people are over there. But we're almost getting back into a Cold War situation.
Oh, see, you're being, there you go being an optimist again, Jim.
Sir?
There you go being an optimist again. I think we're getting ourselves back into a 1914 situation.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. And, you know, it's just amazing how quickly, particularly in this electronically connected world, how that same thing can happen. I mean, back in 1914, it took, from June 28th to August 4th for everybody to line up and decide what they were going to do, and then they thought it was going to be over by Christmas or whatever. And, of course, you saw what kind of war that developed into, the one that was horrible in the world, and the one that it could develop from some of these provocations. It could just change the entire destiny of the planet. And I just don't like to see that.
You know, and for the sake not necessarily of yourself, Jim, and me, not for my sake, but for the sake of the people who will be asked to do the bloody business of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, it would be something that would occur within 15 to 20 minutes. And if things were to go. I'm really concerned about this because I don't like the idea of us being involved in the affairs of another nation. But we have so many problems of our own. And if you were to get a right-wing hawk or hawkish-type president in the White House, meaning the president, the vice president, and his advisors, and you know, the other people who follow along. We go the rounds of Joint Chiefs of Staff and this, that, and the other of exactly what type of advice would be given if some type of provocation were to occur that will be considered, in their eyes, untenable. I worry about people like that.
I do too. And you know, it's kind of interesting. A couple of nights ago, this is tangential but on topic. A couple of nights ago, I was convinced to sit down and watch the recent remake of The Great Gatsby. And you know, it wasn't a terrible movie. I read the book, so I knew what was going to happen. It could be critiqued on a number of levels. But after it was over, I sat and I explained to Margie, with whom I had watched it, why, you know, because Fitzgerald goes to great pains to show the over-the-top nature of the parties and the celebrations and the massive soirees there at the Gatsby Mansion. You remember?
Oh, yeah.
And it's all so vacuous, and it's all so... He goes to such lengths to show how pointless it is. And so then I began to explain to my 21-year-old daughter, The Lost Generation, and Fitzgerald, and John Dos Passos, and Hemingway, and what impact the Great War had on them. Because they had been through something that the world had never really experienced. Better put, the only portion of the world that had ever experienced anything like it were maybe the Gauls invaded by Caesar, or the indigenous Americans invaded by the Spanish conquistadores. A complete destruction of everything that they thought was real.
Oh yeah. All their systems, all their cities, all the borders, and all of the existing governments. How many governments fell? And you saw what would come after it. Just a very destroyed continent. And you know, they still haven't recovered from that, in my opinion. To wit, for example, I'm not trying to get away from the Great Gatsby and your efforts to explain to your daughter. By the way, congratulations on her commencement.
That's Doodle.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the youngest one.
I knew you had one that was going to put on the mortar board and pestle, but nonetheless, and you see how that war created another war. And making a transition from that point to the population of the Russian Republic today. Do you know how many people are in the borders of Russia today?
No.
147 million, that's it. They haven't recovered from World War II yet, generationally.
Well, that's comparable, for instance, to Ireland. Ireland was the only country that did not gain population from the 19th century into the 20th as a result of Ireland still does not have the population that it had before the potato famine.
No, it didn't. It doesn't. And you know, it takes a long time generationally for nations to recover from you know, famine, plague, and war. And I was just thinking exactly what's going to happen over there, in your opinion, in the Ukraine and the Russian Republic.
Well, as far as I can tell, Jim, we are engaging in that ancient America, well, relatively speaking, that ancient United States habit of backing the wrong horse. We've done that all over the world. We did it with Mossadegh, or we did it, you know, with the Shah versus Mossadegh. We did it in Guatemala. We did it in Chile. We did it with Cuba. And sometimes you back the wrong horse. Sometimes you should not go to the races. And frankly, Ukraine is one of those places where we ought not be going to the racetrack that day.
Well, I know we said that we were not going to push NATO into those areas that were formerly occupied by the Soviet Union, but we have. And I do believe that these people feel as though they're being once again encircled. And I'm very much afraid of what's going to happen over there. That's a dangerous situation.
That's the conundrum for the United States, because we do have two object lessons, three if you count things like the Berlin airlift and the Cold War. But we have two very real world, very bloody situations in which we said things like, "Well, this is a European problem. We should probably let the Europeans handle it." We did that twice. We wound up in it. And we make, and without a doubt, Jim, we make far more out of it, out of our participation in it, than maybe we're entitled to, relative, like in the Second World War, with regard to the number of Germans killed by Russians and the number of Germans killed by you know, British and French and American forces. Well, never mind. You know what I mean by that. But it presents a problem for people who see things in terms of military answers. I mean, has Europe gone as long as it has from the end of the Second World War to the present without falling into a giant conflagration? I mean, I was just casting my mind back over, oh, let's say the Napoleonic Wars, and you get over those, and then bang, it's 1848. And so few Americans know anything about the revolutions of 1848 in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not much past that. And well, how do you, hey, look, the Prussians have gone to tour France, and so that's 1870, right? So we make it.
Yeah, the creation of the German Empire celebrated in the Hall of Versailles.
Right.
Interestingly enough.
Yeah. Well. You know, I've got a friend who's rather uncharitable toward the French, who says, what in the world do they need an Arch of Triumph for? The only people who ever use it are the British, the Germans, and the Americans. But that's cold and cruel. But from 1870, we make it 44 years to 1914, and gone again. The next one didn't even last that long. It's over in 1918. And precisely 21 years later, off and going again. Well, this time through, from 1945, we've made it 70 years without Europe engaging in another one of its ritual bloodbaths. And you'd kind of like to see that continue.
I think one of the reasons that hasn't happened is because of the development of weapons. And the consequences of those weapons. I think the development of the atomic bomb, for example, may have caused some right serious problems on Stalin going back on some promises he had made to Roosevelt about Poland and other Eastern nations that had fallen within his sphere of influence by right of conquest or occupation or whatever you want to call it. They were there. And I think the Russian government, and I'm trying to use my words as carefully as I can, I don't think they're going to tolerate a whole lot of interference in what they consider to be their sphere of influence. I think Mr. Putin has a lot of his oligarch friends who have put him into power who could push him into doing things that maybe he should not do. What I'm trying to say is I think we are about to embark upon a very cold war over there that could be extremely hot very quickly. And, of course, that would make World War One and World War Two look like an Easter pageant.
And what I find interesting out of it all, Jim, is that there's the potential there for us to be bitten in the ass by the apparent non-transferability of wisdom. I see this in so many different places. For instance, it is only after the passing away of the first generation to get Social Security, or the generation that saw it enacted in their adult lifetimes, that you get Republicans out there talking about doing away with it. Because the witnesses to pre-Social Security elder poverty are no more. They're just not there. They're gone. They're dead. So they can't, you know, they can't stand there and say, how dare you? I remember when. And frankly, the last doughboys are gone. And the G.I. Joes are going away. I mean,
oh yeah.
I mean, Jesus, some of the, you know, there are Vietnam vets who are pushing 80.
It's just amazing how quickly people forget, and those who are left have no real input into the knowledge base of what we all should stand upon. And to me, that's very frightening. And I think there is just this type of adventurism that is beginning to prevail. There is a netcast force in which we will ensnare only that which is most impossible. I mean, I don't care how many economic relations, hedge funds, this, that, and the other, are involved with, you know, the Eastern Bloc countries, particularly Ukraine and the elements of this country who are behind the Ukraine because of that. But you've got a lot of economic interests in this country who want to create problems for the sake of their own bank accounts and you know, financial interests. I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, the First World War was basically driven more, if you adhere to what's called the Fritz Fischer thesis, of economic interests of countries. It really just galvanized that whole conflagration that began in 1914. It just didn't start because of the Archduke being murdered. But you had so many economic ties that were involved between, for example, the nations of the Entente Cordiale and, of course, the Central Powers. There was a lot of economic stuff in there. It was driven. What I'm trying to say is the underlying causes of the First World War were driven, in addition to nationalism, but they were driven by economic reasons. I know the German business community under the Kaiser thought that it would be a great thing for it to increase their profit margins and things of that nature. And on the other side, you had similar interests of the opposing nations. It just appears to me, it's like, as I think we were referring early in the conversation, that history has begun to repeat itself. And people have just forgotten, and they think that well, something's going to happen at the last minute, and it's just going to stop, and we're going to continue to go on. But I don't think that's going to be the case. I mean, that's just a personal opinion. And while we are flying our planes over the China Sea and tickling their noses, when much of the national debt in this country is owned by China, I just don't understand the lack of diplomacy and the lack of clear-headedness about some of these issues. I really don't. Of course, when you go back and look at
But it may be just as what you said with the beginning of the First World War. This may be more about economics. And you know, the left in this country understood it from the get-go as a matter of economics. The socialists, the communists, the wobblies, all understood it as workers being asked to kill other workers for the benefit of the billionaire, or, you know, millionaire class.
Mm-hmm.
because, you know, you'll note that, well, granted, Kaiser Wilhelm lost his job, and the House of Romanov lost a lot more. But the folks that came out on the House of Windsor only got richer.
That's true.
And,
you know, it's a funny thing between
the Krupps family built some magnificent, if you can use words like that to describe such a thing, magnificent field pieces during the First World War. And even though Germany lost, they were still filthy rich industrialists able to produce magnificent field pieces for the Third Reich.
Oh, absolutely.
And now they make coffee makers. And when I get it, and the folks at Otis have apparently been overtaken by the Tyson folks, T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. I'm never sure on how to pronounce that. Might be Thiessen.
Thiessen.
Which, you
Fritz
know,
Thiessen.
Yeah, right. That's it. Oh, hello, Fritz. A financier for a certain madman. Funny how that works out. The money will out. And see, one of the beauty, you know, understand, American industrialists in 1914, American industrialists absolutely wanted to stay out of the First World War. You know why? Because they were selling to both sides.
Of course, it was a great market for them. Absolutely.
The business of America is business.
They were lending money to, for example, the Russian Empire. And, of course, they would say, you know, no war, no loan, this, that, and the other. Well, I don't think we have to ponder a great deal to draw our conclusions about what happened there. But I just wanted to, you know, just interject that situation that we're dealing with in Ukraine and the powers that be over there. And I just wish that we could stay out of their business. I mean, Mr. Putin and his oligarchical friends who put him in power or whoever, and of course you've got the Soviet military. Of course they want to have it rebuilt the way it was. I mean, the Russian Federation wants, in my opinion, to re-expand its influence and its borders and basically to recover from the dissolution that occurred in the early 90s.
Well, Putin has said that, you know, has he not, that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was a great tragedy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got to look at the man's education, where he was trained, and what his job was when he was in East Berlin. And I just have a feeling that these people don't want to be hemmed in into their own borders as they exist today. I think they would love to come in and reestablish their former hegemony in some type, and just on economic. And, you know, in my opinion, it is their sphere of influence, and I just wish we could come to some type of understanding with them in which we would not be wasting so much of our own blood and treasure when we have so many other problems in different parts of the world. And that's about all I have to say.
Well,
really.
Different parts of the world. How about we attend to the problems in our own part of the world, too, Jim? You know what I mean?
Well, I think that's exactly. And
we are the different part of the world.
Well, yeah, that's what I was fixing to refer to also. It just appears to me as though this country is becoming so divisive and so absolutely driven to the point that people just won't even speak to each other or even try to sit down and reason together. I mean, you know, that's just my own thought there. But that's all I really had to say, and it was just something that was weighing heavily upon my mind. Because I remember some of the close calls we had back during the Cold War. Oh, God.
Indeed.
It should be in 1983. Oh, Lord.
Jim, thank you very kindly, and have yourself a wonderful evening.
Well, same to you, sir.
All right. Take care.
Good night.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim calling from not too terribly far from here. Both lines open as we wind down the program for the evening. 304-574-8178 and 304-663-HORN. 304-663-4676. That's the stress line. A couple of slogans. I was looking for, you know, something that the ignorant can chant. And I got a couple of dandies from Carol. We're dumb. We're proud. We scream it really loud. I like it. Or you can vote with your cell phones to star horn. No, that doesn't really. No, that's a joke. You can vote for number two. We hate. It's fun. We'll shoot you with our gun. I think both of them are quite excellent, really. Back over to the Skype line. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hey, Bob. Can you hear me?
I gotcha.
Hey, Bob. It's your friend Mark calling.
That's what I thought. Hey, Mark.
Hey, I just wanted to comment on Jim. We take all things into consideration, but you know, Jim's a couple years older than me, and he was a Cold War warrior, and I'm not criticizing his perspective. And I think, you know, there's a degree of understandability to it, but I look at the situation with the Russians and Putin. I think his government seems to have been very precariously perched, and he knew he had to make a move to back up Yanukovych, another fellow fascist. And I would not go, I would not be surprised if George Bush Jr., and his cohorts didn't basically give Putin the green light, maybe even in advance of what he did. It's very similar to what we have done in Iraq.
You say giving the green light, that reminds me of the Glaspie memo. Remember that?
April Glaspie?
Yes.
April Glaspie, sure. Giving the
green light
policy
to Saddam Hussein to invade Kuwait. We take no position in Arab conflicts.
Correct, yeah, correct. And
translated into the original hillbilly as, let's you and him fight.
it's just sucker him in so we can squash him like a fly. And you know, and I actually, not a young Marine, actually I was an old Marine, I was watching that all develop. I remember being in the kitchen of my house in Cherokee County, Woodstock, Georgia, back and forth, listening to that conversation, Bob, concerning April Glaspie. I thought, well, there's a ray of hope here, maybe this will work out, and I won't get caught up in this. And I did get caught up in Desert Storm, but I guess what I'm saying is, I see Putin as more of a fascist. He's worth, well, way more than the Koch brothers. And, you know, maybe individually, but compared to one of the brothers, but maybe not both of them. But the point is, it's just fascism on the march, and it's really no different. I don't see really a Cold War reshaping itself. And I don't doubt the Jim's perspective that there aren't some old generals that wouldn't like a certain amount of strength. We could say that about our own armies as well, but I think something to keep an eye on is something that's cruising around right now off the northern coast of Japan, and the Chinese and folks taking a look at different islands and that's probably about oil resources as well and gas. But
well, it's also about it's also, Mark, about whiteness. It's the same thing that was going on in 1940. We were all watching Europe because, well, you know, that's white people fighting. And
correct.
You know, by the same extension, we would never have dropped Fat Man and Little Boy on, you know, Berlin and Munich.
Yeah, matter of fact, I've never thought about it like that, but that makes immediate sense to me. And you know, knowing you and knowing that we think very similar, And then your comments earlier in tonight's show concerning Jefferson Davis. You know, it's one thing, one interesting thing that we don't ever talk about when it concerning Jefferson Davis. He was not elected. He was appointed. He wasn't democratically elected. So it's an argument for democracy that Lincoln was elected, maybe, even though we're not a democracy. But it's just kind of interesting. But
well, I mean, that's why I say democracy in this country has always been aspirational and not operational.
We have to keep pushing. But I don't worry about
you know, as long as we don't as long as we don't let Treebeard and Celery participate in the democracy.
With the wrong complexion, and I just one more thing, I know you got to get going, Ed, but one other thing about Jim's maybe aware of this, but France, Italy, and the United States had collectively signed oil deals. I guess it's the shale oil off the coast of Crimea, more specifically within the Ukraine. I don't know how many miles out.
Well, I'll be dipped. Hydrocarbons entered the picture. How do you like that? Who'd have thunk?
Well, there we go again. So, you know, so
right,
Joe
Biden's son is vice president of fracking Ukraine? Or something like
that. Is that a fact?
He's involved, yeah. We sent him over there to encourage the Ukrainians to frack their water to death.
And then we elected a chocolate minister, but I'll take him over over Yanukovych. But, there we go again. It's resource wars. And it's like 3 days of the Condor at the end where, you know, it's about oil, and it's always about
it's
oil.
It's either that or the end of Soylent. It's either that or the end of Soylent Green, and Soylent Green is people, Mark.
And then people were the carbon fuel, were they not?
There we go.
Yeah, there we go. Anyway, I just wanted to call and let Jim know that it's not a serious situation, but I don't see it reshaping. Matter of fact, I think their own people will put it down, and that's why he had his competition shot just a mile from their White House. So, in any case, I don't worry about him, and I worry more about our own people's and go Bernie Sanders. So, anyway, Bob.
All right, well, Mark, it's awfully good to hear from you. Thank you very much, very kindly for calling in.
I will call you when I get back home. I'm heading west on that. I'm heading east. I mean, so I'm way out west, Bob. So I'll be heading back to your part of our country here.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good, Mark. You take care.
Okay.
Bye.
All right. Semper Fi, Bob. Okay.
Our buddy Mark, who is not in Florida. So that brings us pretty close to the end of the program this evening. Thank you for your participation. Thank you. In whatever way you do it, I love having people like Lucy to think about and all the others from whom I've never received an email. You know, just kind of get one out of the blue every now and then. It's pleasant. You know, I've been thinking for a while now, for the last week or so, about Jackie and Lynn out there in British Columbia, listening and having dinner. I thought about them this evening when I ruined dinner by mentioning what a dog returns to. Sorry. I do that. I think about you guys. Sometimes I just wonder who you are. That's how it works. Because, see, all of you are inside this little microphone I talk into. Isn't that cool? So, yeah, we're done for the evening. Thank you for joining in, however you have. Thank you for everybody who makes all of this go. You who sit and listen and participate and send messages and tweet and Facebook and call and chat room and everything, thank you. Thank you to those of you who support the continued existence of this program. It is ever so important. This is one of those nights we have sometimes. Not a lot of them, but they're disturbing when they happen. When, you know, nothing happens at the PayPal button and there are no notes about telling Boss Man Wayne that he can leave the spider-proof gloves at home. Yeah. But thank you for keeping this effort going. Thank you, one and all. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you to John Fox, our webmaster and keeper of my technological sanity. Thank you very kindly. Special thanks again to Greg for a big box of wonderful stuff that we're going to use to make the foray into the wonderful world of all things Mac more pleasant and hopefully technologically sound. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACAC.org. Please, we have fallen behind in the campaign to get funding for the Judy Bond Center for Appalachian Preservation. Please go to my Facebook page. Please go and use your 10 votes per day with state assist to get us back into the running. We have fallen behind, and we need a much bigger effort than we're getting. Please. I mean, you know, if you've got a couple of different Facebook accounts, just saying. yeah, Carol noting, uh-oh, fundraising nights like this. How about some Rush Limbaugh reruns? It gives me the shivers. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful evening. Prayer meeting Wednesday tomorrow with a guest evangelist. And yes, always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you.